From PowerlineBlog.com, this is Powerline with John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Mierengoff, and Stephen Hayward.
Welcome to the Powerline Show. I'm John Hinderacher. I'm joined by Scott Johnson and Steve Hayward, and we are broadcasting from my kitchen. Steve Hayward is in town on business. Scott's over for dinner. We are salivating over a plate of gigantic New York strip steaks, which we're going to put on the grill as soon as this podcast is completed. And the grilling is going to be done by Steve Hayward, who claims to be an expert. We'll see.
Well, they call me the cool Duke of the Coals out in California, you know.
I've heard that. So in our next podcast, we'll report on how the steaks turned out. In the meantime, we are going to go straight to Steve's interview with Bob Kaufman. Steve, why don't you tell us what that's all about?
Right. Well, Bob Kaufman, Robert Kaufman, he's one of my colleagues at Pepperdine University's Graduate School of Public Policy. He has a brand new book out this week called The Obama Doctrine, and he's fairly harsh on Obama, as you might mention. I'll add that he's a biographer of Henry Jackson. That book came out back in, I think, 1999 or 2000. Terrific book. And his sequel to that is he has currently started on a biography of Joe Lieberman, with Joe Lieberman's enthusiastic cooperation. So without further ado, I will throw it over to Bob, and we'll pick it up at the end. We're talking today with Professor Robert Kaufman, whose brand new book will come out soon from the University Press of Kentucky called Dangerous Doctrine: How Obama's Grand Strategy Weakened America. So good morning, Bob. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
So let's start here. You know, a few weeks ago, there was quite a sensation when Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic did an interview with President Obama and talked about the Obama Doctrine, which, of course, is a lot of what your book talks about. Now, Goldberg didn't really explain it very fully, although that interview was very revealing. But your book starts with the Obama Doctrine. I mean, we know about the Truman Doctrine in history and the Reagan Doctrine, but we really haven't ever heard the Obama Doctrine enunciated, have we? What is the Obama Doctrine as you understand it?
Goldberg's interview with Obama is progress in one sense. Because for years, Obama's defenders denied that there was any overarching doctrine. So did the president. I made the case in this book, and Goldberg's interview confirmed it, that President Obama has followed a very systematic outlook on international affairs, very consistently, especially given the vagaries of politics. I also argue that this has been terrible for the United States, and we're going to reap the whirlwind for years to come, unless, to quote Demosthenes, we stop doing what we're doing now.
Right, yeah. In your first chapter, you identify six different aspects of what you call the Obama Doctrine: the fact that he's anti-American exceptionalism, that he's for this very weak multilateralism, and so forth. I want to spend a minute on point number five, which is that Obama is a champion of what's been called soft power for such a long time. First of all, is there such a thing as soft power? Is it a power at all?
Soft power is an accoutrement. It's like frosting on a cake, but soft power can never substitute for hard power. When countries or nations or empires are ascendant, their culture has some added pull that has a marginal effect in certain circumstances. But in general, when you lose your hard power, it's no substitute for soft power. Let me add another caveat, that for people like Joe Nye and Hillary Clinton, and Hillary Clinton calls it smart power, their assumption is that soft power is always a good thing. Think again. If you go back to 9/11 and you listen to what bin Laden and his fatwas were angry about, it's precisely American soft power, the culture of the United States that came to the world and led them to believe we were the great but decadent Satan. So one, soft power is exaggerated. Two, it's derivative of hard power. And three, contrary to its advocates, it doesn't always have a benign effect.
Right. One of my teachers of international relations, who you remind me of very often, Harold Rood, used to say the basic tool of diplomacy is a rifle, right? And an infantry is the basis of all political power. I try to think of who Obama can be compared to as a historical analogy among presidents, and there really isn't one. I mean, we talk about Jimmy Carter sometimes, but even Jimmy Carter figured some things out by the end. The closest I can think of is that he's almost Henry Wallace, who, of course, was never elected. But did we finally elect Henry Wallace president with Obama?
We did. Henry Wallace with self-confidence feasted on steroids. I would say that Obama is a composite of Jimmy Carter's first 3 years and Jimmy Carter out of office with Henry Wallace and what a McGovern presidency might have looked like if McGovern had the affirmative self-confidence that Obama did. McGovern acted out of guilt. Obama is acting out of affirmation that he's the tribune of the world when he's trying to reconcile us with the world. If I could put it in one nutshell, Obama's the opposite of Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan thought he was an ordinary man leading an exceptional nation. Obama thinks he's an extraordinary figure leading a badly flawed nation suffering from the arrogance of American power. That's his diagnosis, and his remedy for all things, the link in all of his policies, is the belief that American power, rather than the threat posed by our enemies, constitutes our greatest threat and is what needs to be restrained more than anything else.
Right. I think I'd add that, at least say something in a mild defense of, say, George McGovern and even Jimmy Carter. I mean, George McGovern flew 25 bomber missions and was pro-American. And likewise, Jimmy Carter had served in the Navy, was pro-American. You really don't get the feeling that Obama is terribly pro-American or that he's, you know, he's even that proud of his own country.
He's accepted or embraced or embodied a narrative of America as being a badly flawed nation until the day they elected him. And his approval of America, and this is true of the First Lady, is contingent on whether the country supports him. And any type of resistance to what he wants to do, transforming America's relations with the world, transforming the American social contract at home, he doesn't just deem it wrong, he deems it illegitimate. And that's one of the really dangerous things about President Obama, because unlike President Clinton, who had a learning curve and a deep streak of pragmatism, even if one could quarrel with his general outlook as I did, there'll be no resets with Obama. He's so preternaturally self-confident in his vision that the only way to change it is to have an election where someone fundamentally different comes to power.
Right. Let's talk about Europe for a couple of minutes. You know, I was in Europe in 2008, within a few weeks of the election, and every European I met was so excited that America had elected Barack Obama. And I haven't been back much. I've been back a couple times, but I have the sense that the excitement has worn off because, among other things, it's pretty clear that some of the problems you're having in Europe right now are the result of the abdication of American leadership in the Middle East, the disdain that Obama holds most of Europe in, it seems to me. So, I mean, what do you think about this? The Europeans, what do you think Europeans are thinking right now about all this?
The Europeans are thinking that sometimes it's dangerous to get what you wish for. A few years ago, Robert Kagan wrote a book that has some flaws, but it contains a basic insight that the Europeans lived in this postmodern world where power didn't matter, so long as they could take for granted some great power behaving like an adult to protect them. That was us. Now that we've begun to behave like Europeans, and now that Putin has revealed that he really means what he says, that he considers the demise of the Soviet Union a great tragedy and wants to reverse that to create some modern version of the Russian Empire across East Central Europe, the Europeans, particularly in the East, are terrified. And now that Obama, who disdains Europe, is wiretapping pro-American German chancellors such as Angela Merkel or denying that there's a special relationship with Great Britain and calling the Falklands the Malvinas, indicating that he sides with the Argentinians rather than with Britain, as Reagan sided with Thatcher. Europeans are beginning to realize that in a post-American world, they are in grave danger, facing Putin to the east and a seething Islamic crisis on their borders to the south.
Yeah. Let's talk about some remedies that you you conclude with in the book. Again, I think you have six main items to go along with your six parts of Obama's doctrine.
Yes.
What do you think is the most important? I mean, you mentioned that we ought to revive the United States as the default power in the world. We ought to embrace our role as the preeminent superpower. Some very traditional ideas like deterrence that have been falling away and so forth. What do you think are some of the most important, or what would you put at the top of your list?
Three things. You have to maintain American military preeminence. Secondly, you have to distinguish, as Obama has not, between decent democratic allies and noxious rogue regimes bent on destroying freedom. One of the great flaws of Obama's doctrine, he's combined the worst features of liberal multilateralism in a paradigm called neorealism. Liberal multilateralism posits that the UN can serve as the arbiter of international legitimacy, which, as Samuel Johnson put it, of a second marriage, is a triumph of hope over experience. Neorealism posits that the nature of the regime or the ideology that animates it doesn't matter. But this is why Obama engages dictatorships and undermines decent democratic friends like the Poles, the Czechs, the Israelis, and our allies in the Far East and across the world. And the other thing that Obama has to can't comprehend, but the next president needs to restore Ronald Reagan's notion that however imperfect we are, the world without the United States maintaining some semblance of geopolitical order is what Thomas Hobbes feared, a world that's going to become increasingly nasty, solitary, brutish, and short. So if I had three things that I think the next administration has to do, I'd focus on those, but there's a warning. There's no quick fix. There's no shortcut. Obama has inflicted an enormous hit on American power and prestige, lowering the barriers to aggression, demoralizing decent allies, and emboldening foes such as an increasingly assertive authoritarian China, Putin, and every miserable regime in the Middle East, particularly Iran, which is the gravest danger that Obama has appeased rather than confronted.
Let's talk about a few things outside the four corners of your book, that bear on the book. And in particular, this is salient because of what's happening in the Republican primary race. You know, Donald Trump seems to have tapped into what I wonder might be the latent strain in the Republican Party that goes back to its DNA of the 19th and early 20th century. That is protectionism. Republicans were always a protectionist party. And second, isolationism, right? I mean, Trump has even gone so far as to use the phrase America first without seeming to have any historical knowledge of what that conveys and connotes. But nonetheless, I think you see a reversion to the old, almost Taft-style republicanism, right? What do you make of all this that's happening right now?
Well, first of all, Trump is historically challenged and does not understand the very, very dubious, disastrous pedigree of the term America First associated with Charles Lindbergh, who was a defeatist and an appeaser and an apologist for Nazi Germany. Let me distinguish Lindbergh from Bob Taft, who is historically wrong but an honorable man. What Trump has done, and you saw a premonition of this in Rand Paul, is revive, you're right, Steve. It's like Henry Wallace was the bad gene of the Democratic Party that Truman suppressed. Bob Taft and the idea that America can abnegate its role in the world. You can't run, you can't hide, but this is an enormous temptation, and Trump has revived that strain, and the irony is that Trump's foreign policy although the premises are different, operationally would almost be an Obama third term.
Yeah, that's good. You want to talk about Joe Lieberman a little bit and the book you're working on?
I'm starting another book, a biography of Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, really a companion of my biography of Scoop Jackson, which encouraged the senator to ask me to do it. And the theme of the Jackson book was, there were two things. One, what was Jackson's role in the 70s in helping to win the Cold War when it looked like the West was going to give up? And the theme was, in many ways, he and his people were the John the Baptist that laid the framework for Ronald Reagan winning it in the 80s. The other theme is, why didn't a man like Jackson become president? Why did he become an outlier? And most Jacksonians, Henry Jackson, not Andrew, but right. Reagan. And the reason is what happened to the Democratic Party. Joe Lieberman brings the story up to the present, that in the 90s and 2000, Joe Lieberman represented an honorable, Truman, hawkish strain in the Democratic Party that rejected McGovernism and believed, much like Ronald Reagan did, that the United States had to act as an exceptional nation and the world's default power. When you look at the fate of Joe Lieberman rising to the pinnacle of being Al Gore's vice presidential choice and then becoming such a pariah over the Iraq War, Iraq is to the Democrats in the 21st century what Vietnam was in the 20th, the party has moved to the left, symbolized by Lieberman's political demise and Barack Obama's ascent. So the story of Lieberman is his honorable tradition, and more broadly, what Lieberman's political demise means to the detriment of the country for the Democratic Party in the 21st century.
Right. I remember your Jackson book came out in, what, 1999, 2000?
2000.
Right. I remember reading the very last paragraph where you said, it was funny at the time, gosh, the only person left the Democratic Party who's like Jackson is Joe Lieberman. And then, you know, he signs up with Gore, and it looked for a while like he might do the dutiful thing running mates do and move to the left. And, you know, in a certain ways you might say that he did, but he didn't stay there. That's quite right.
When I saw Senator Lieberman after the publication of the Jackson book, he very much liked the book, but he said I was wrong about him being the last of the Jackson Democrats. This was 2000. In 2007, at a Jackson Foundation function in honor of Donald Rumsfeld, Senator Lieberman walked up to me and said, Bob, before you say anything, you were right. I am the last of the Democrats. And so much so that in 2008 at the Republican convention, Joe Lieberman, who would have been John McCain's Secretary of State, spoke for John McCain and against President Obama. That's the distilled essence of what happened to what I call Cold War liberalism in the 20th and 21st century. If you look at Jackson and Lieberman as a tandem, this tradition is dead. And what's really dangerous now is the Republican Party seems to be in a fight as to whether that Reagan tradition will live on or whether Donald Trump and people like him will destroy it. And not only the fate of our country, but the fate of international freedom depends on the answer to that.
Yeah, in retrospect, I kind of thought this at the time, but I thought it was too bad that McCain didn't make him his running mate, as everyone said he wanted to. And I mean, obviously, that was a difficult thing to do, but on the other hand, it was a huge opportunity. Just as, by the way, I think Ronald Reagan missed an opportunity to make Scoop Jackson a Secretary of Defense, which had been thought about, I think you wrote about that some in your book, right?
I did. I actually talked to some of the McCain people indirectly, and one of my suggestions was that McCain ought to have named his cabinet right after the convention to put pressure on Obama, who was a protean candidate, appealing to everyone to define himself. Now, whether you made Lieberman your vice president or secretary of state or defense, or Mitt Romney, secretary of the treasury, I think that was a missed opportunity in the fluidity of 2008 to force Obama to define who he was. One of the tragedies of 2008 that people forget when they blame Iraq for the demise of the Republican Party, until the financial meltdown, McCain was running even or slightly better because the country rightly saw McCain as a much more reliable commander-in-chief. When Republicans run away from the responsibilities of the United States, one, they're doing a policy disservice, but two, they're not serving their political interests either. Isolationism, the Democrats are going to win on that.
Right, right, yeah. I have my own funny Lieberman story. I only met him a couple of times, but I enjoyed telling him something I'm not sure he knew, but he always suspected, which was that Ronald Reagan secretly supported him in his first Senate race against Lowell Weicker in 1988.
William Buckley supported him, not
right.
so secretly.
Right, that's right.
A, because he knew Lieberman from Yale, right. and B, he detested Weicker for
yes.
very good reasons.
Yeah.
So it was a reinforcing
right.
incentive for Buckley.
Right. I may try and find this for you. Reagan went so far as to start writing a personal check of a campaign contribution to Lieberman. And Ken Duberstein told me this. He was last chief of staff. Said, no, Mr. President, I understand you don't like Weicker. Reagan had called Weicker in his diary a no-good, pompous fathead, which I like. And Duberstein had to tell President Reagan, look, I know you like him, I know you hate Weicker, but you're the leader of the party. You can't be giving a campaign contribution, which would be disclosed, of course, to a Democrat. Reagan, in his usual way, says, oh, okay, I guess. I told Senator Lieberman that story one time, and also in some little gathering we were at, and everyone's always a little formal, and I make some comment about how Joe Lieberman is proof that you can be a liberal, even a progressive, but still be pro-American. And his very sort of low voice comment was, it's a very low bar to clear in the Democratic Party today, which I thought was pretty funny.
And it's becoming a lower bar in the Democratic Party. One of the tragedies of this election in terms of intellectual and moral confusion is that some people, even on my side of the spectrum, and I think they're wrong, have identified Hillary Clinton as plausibly the more hawkish of the potential candidates. That's very dangerous because largely my book makes the case that with marginal objections, Hillary Clinton has been the first mate on Obama's Titanic, morally assaulting American power and physically assaulting American power by dismantling the American defense budget so that we're going to have a defense establishment smaller than what we had as a percentage of the GDP in 1940 when we were woefully unprepared for what was to come.
Yeah, actually, we should say a little bit more about Hillary. I'm trying to remember in reading quickly through your book, you discussed the Libya adventure, I think, don't you?
Adventure is a nice word for it. Debacle is another.
Well, I was going to say misadventure, but yeah, yes.
Well, that's leading from behind. And before we get to that, even though in her memoirs she's trying to cover her tracks, it's Hillary Clinton, not Obama, who came up with the entire notion of the reset. That's her term, and she went through this, for her, a theatrical demonstration of the reset with the phone in the office, etc. But this leading from behind, when you look at Libya, I mean, this is the distilled essence of what not to do. If you're going to go in, you get the approval of the Congress, not the Arab League or NATO or the United Nations. And if you look at Libya, this is related to the failure of Iraq. We had won the Iraq War the way we won World War I, and what doomed it is Obama making withdrawal the priority. In Libya, likewise, when the United Nations mission creeped into regime change, which was inevitable, we have left a power vacuum in Libya that's become literally a training ground for every radical element in the Middle East, contributing to this raging sectarian war that probably wouldn't have occurred if we had negotiated a status of force agreement, left an American presence in Iraq, put pressure on Iran, and not allowed Iraq to be an autobahn for the Iranians to support Assad, Hezbollah, touching off literally a regional conflagration and the rise of ISIS. So if Hillary Clinton is marginally better than President Obama, it is, as I've said in other contexts, the equivalent of being the best looking person in the physics department.
that leads me to another historical analogy, which is, I always thought that Obama was in a lot of ways an epigon of Woodrow Wilson. I mean, philosophically and certain other ways that are similar. But of course, it was the reaction to Wilson that gave us the isolationism of the 1920s. And it's not an exact parallel, but it looks to me like Obama's setting us up for a post-Iraq war period of confusion, right?
Well, it's hard to say worse, but Obama's actually worse than Woodrow Wilson. Wilson was maladroit in his unwillingness to compromise over the League of Nations. Henry Cabot Lodge was not an isolationist. He supported a forerunner of NATO. But Wilson at least understood that isolationism was no longer a plausible strategy for the conditions of the 20th century. Wilson, at least in the Naval Bill of 1916, committed the United States to a Navy second to none as a matter of principle. Obama is worse because he combines Wilson's progressive conceit and contempt for the Constitution with a deep-seated anti-Americanism that emanates from being a man of the post-68 left that actually feasts on steroids the worst features of Wilson without the redeeming belief that Wilson had, for all his flaws, that the United States was still the best alternative, given all the other alternatives. So I think there is a parallel in intellectual arrogance, this professorial notion that he knows better and that he sees, as Obama puts it, like Wilson did, the long arc of history. Both were uncomfortable with constitutional niceties, thinking the Constitution flawed and outmoded. But Obama is actually more dangerous than Wilson in his fundamental anti-Americanism.
Are there any other questions I should ask you? I would, you know. Any other main points I've missed?
There's one main point. That Obama's, and I actually identify it in the book as a seventh point of his doctrine, David Remnick, his fawning biographer, made the point that Obama envisages himself as a bridge reconciling the United States, in the United States, the races. I take that one step further, but I'm not fawning, I'm very critical. Obama also considers himself a transformational figure, the bridge reconciling a badly flawed United States with the world. And this accounts for this obsession with engaging adversaries and abandoning friends because of Obama's preternatural self-confidence of throwing the Iranian Green Revolution in the spring of 2009 under the bus in the hopes of dealing with the militant, virulently anti-American mullahs. Treating a decent Democratic Netanyahu as a pariah while fawning over Castro's totalitarian tyranny, abandoning the Eastern European allies who committed political capital, Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary, to deploy missile defense while engaging an increasingly authoritarian Putin, ignoring the illiberal trajectory in China under this regime, an infamous document number 9 defining freedom as an existential threat in any form, the prodigious Chinese military buildup that is now casting doubt on our reliability in the world's most important geopolitical region. This conceit that he can transform these enmities and this arrogance of blaming all of our problems, global warming, on George W. Bush, this is really a very dangerous feature, and it manifests itself in another way. The inability to admit, even utter the word Islamic fascism, And if I had one emblem of Obama's obtuseness on this, it's the spring of 2009 when the infamous Major Hassan went on a murderous spree at Fort Hood, killing 15, wounding 48, shouting Allah Abu Akbar, God is great, in Arabic. Now, you don't have to be Clausewitz to figure out that this is a declaration of war inspired by Islamic fascism. Obama's too smart for that. His Defense Department insisted to the contrary. This had nothing to do with Islam, but was, I quote, workplace violence. That is the Obama doctrine in the essence. And if you can't admit or can't recognize or don't have the moral or geopolitical antennae to know who your friends and enemies are, you can't do anything because you lack the moral and intellectual and strategic clarity to do what the Constitution says you're supposed to do. It doesn't say health care, but it does mandate that we are obliged, our elected officials are obliged, as a constitutional duty, to provide for the common defense. President Obama's doctrine is in complete dereliction of that duty.
Yeah, I remember that episode and thinking, he's all but said, and you'll remember the antecedent, we need to get over our inordinate fear of Islamic terrorism. Right.
It's what Jimmy Carter said at Notre Dame in 1977, where his admiring biographer Peter Bourne said that Carter thereby freed us from the fears of the Cold War. And one of the, we need the equivalent of Reagan, who, in response to Carter at the first press conference he gave, said, by the way, on that issue of the inordinate fear of communism, Soviet regime will lie, cheat, and steal to achieve its ultimate objective of world domination.
Yeah.
What we need today as a first principle, a necessary if not sufficient condition for an American revival, is a neo-Reaganite of the 21st century saying to the world and to the country what Reagan said in his first press conference, reversing the decade of decline and the dismal 1970s and detente.
Right. I mean, the equivalent would be when people say death to America, we should take them seriously, that's what they mean, right?
Historically, when we've ignored totalitarian regimes espousing noxious ideologies, 1930s, the left said, oh, Mein Kampf is a psychological manifestation of the unfairness of Versailles, and the remedy for that is conciliation. The realist, the unrealistic realist, said, no, it's just ideology is for internal consumption. Don't take it seriously. Only one man got it right.
Yeah.
Winston Churchill, who said, Mein Kampf means what it says and makes Germany an existential threat that can't be dealt with by traditional means. Reagan was the Churchill of the second half of the 20th century, and we sorely need that type of figure for the 21st century, or freedom is in peril, because, as Ronald Reagan put it, often it takes generations to win your freedom. If you forget how you won it, you can lose it in a generation, and that's what I fear, particularly from President Obama, but I also fear it from my own party, whose rage has become so blinding at Obama that it's become self-destructive.
Right. Let's talk about one more subject that moves even further away from the book, and that's Bernie Sanders. You were at the University of Vermont for many years, and you, I think, not only saw him up close in person, you knew him a little bit, didn't you?
I did, and I prepared one of his congressional opponents, Susan Sweetser. Can see how effectively I did it. And it wasn't any gift on my part. I was the only conservative Republican with a PhD within 500 miles who would admit it. So, yes, I saw Bernie Sanders in the Vermont State House. And what's really astounding about Bernie Sanders is that personally, he's a sour, grumpy man. He makes Hillary Clinton, when people get to know him, look charming by comparison. So it's one of the ironies of this election that he is the darling of the young people. When objectively speaking, he's such a gloomy, doomy, almost irascibly miserable figure.
Well, thanks very much, Bob, and good luck with Dangerous Doctrine when it comes out here in a couple weeks.
Thank you. I tend to write things that qualify me for the Witness Protection Program in academics. This is no exception. Thanks for having me, Steve.
Great interview, Steve. The Obama Doctrine, I think it's kind of the opposite of the Trump Doctrine. It's we always lose. That's the Obama Doctrine. No matter what the issue is, where it is in the world, bottom line is America loses. Is that a fair paraphrase or am I being too harsh?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, you know, there's this huge uncertainty right now. Trump says one thing one day and another thing the next. He was, you know, been very critical of George W. Bush and then says we should stay out of the Middle East, let Russia take care of Syria. And then in the next breath, he says we're going to wipe out ISIS and kill their families and children and it'll be, I'll do it quickly. And, you know, what's to make of all this? So I don't know. I'm very worried that the Republican Party is confused on foreign policy now. I think there are segments of the party who are throwbacks to some extent to the old Robert Taft nationalist neo-isolationist viewpoint now that the Cold War is over.
America first.
America first. Isn't that amazing that Trump would say that, right? Yeah, Bob commented on that, of course, in the interview. And he seems to have no historical memory of what that phrase meant.
The true Obama doctrine, though, is harm your friends and help your enemies, isn't
right.
it, Steve?
Yeah, it sure seems to be, yeah. On the other hand, Hillary Clinton presents such a juicy target on foreign policy in the campaign.
Well, she did such a good job as Secretary of State.
Right. Just ask the Libyans.
She's got bragging rights. We came, we saw, we killed Gaddafi. Well, wasn't that her theme until the day after?
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Right.
Right. Well, Steve, just briefly to your point, I think, you know, I wouldn't emphasize the Republican Party. I mean, I think that the average Republican is more internationalist, more interventionist, more hawkish, more pro-America, more patriotic, you know, than the average citizen, the average Democrat or independent. But I think the whole country is moving in a more isolationist direction. And I think if you look at American history, that's kind of been the norm. You know, we get roused from the isolationist slumber only by necessity. And the default preference is to have as little as possible to do with countries across the ocean and to mind our own business. And I think that's clearly the direction in which the American people in general are moving.
Yeah, well, we don't like long wars, and we've had two of them in the last two generations, right?
We're still not done with Afghanistan. We seem to be back in Iraq. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, right.
I've just been reading Lynn Olson's history of the debate between 1939 and 1941, preceding our entry into World War II, that involved America First and the Internationalist Republicans, who supported Roosevelt sometimes secretly, and Roosevelt's caution in engineering us to support Great Britain in the days before World War II. And there are differences that emerge, but there are so many striking, I'll say, echoes with the current scene. It's really an educational book. So much I didn't know. It's kind of, you know, 450 pages of tightly written narrative, and you want to know more about just about everything in it. There are so many folks, prominent folks whose names appear and who make cameo appearances, one of whom, for example, is Kingman Brewster.
Oh
my goodness.
Who turns out as a Yale student to have been the head of the America First Committee at Yale University.
That's probably the high point of his career from a political standpoint.
So it's just such an interesting book and in its own way casts a kind of light on what we're going through right now.
You know, he was the first person who put me on the theorem that you should be very suspicious of people with reversible names. By that I mean, he could have been Brewster Kingman and it would have made no difference.
How about Henry James. John would say that.
Two first names.
Terrible, terrible writer. That should have been a clue. Never read anything written by James Henry. Well, you know, on a more serious note, we've been talking about American retreat overseas and so on. America's in retreat at home, too. In certain obvious ways. And Scott, you are doing a fantastic public service in covering what's got to be the number one trial going on in the United States right now. It's taking place in the federal courthouse here in Minneapolis in front of Judge Michael Davis, a man whom you and I both know, and the three remaining Minnesota men, as you have forever dubbed them, the ones that didn't plead guilty or escape to Syria, are on trial for terrorism-related offenses. And you have commented on Powerline on the jury selection, and now the trial is underway. And, you know, what are you learning there? Is it interesting? What's going on?
Well, I think there are elements of the case that are going to be news all over the country. The government just made its opening statement today and put on its first three witnesses, today being May 11th. I hope this is online close enough to make that sound like it's not old news. But among the bombshells that the government dropped in its opening statement was the news that one of the Minnesota men, you know, Minnesota is number one in sending foreign fighters to join ISIS. We're number one.
It's all these Swedes and Norwegians. They just can't resist the pull of jihad in Syria and Iraq.
Yeah, Lutheran Norwegians. And, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
And you know, the House Homeland Security Committee released a report in September of this past year that showed that Minnesota had contributed more foreign fighters to ISIS than any other state in the United States, or more wannabe fighters, of whom these 10 are in a group of about 50. And one of the ones who made it, though, is a guy named Abdi Nur, N-U-R. And in its opening statement today, the government indicated that Nur had sent a list of 16 Minnesotans whom it wanted one of these guys to murder in Minnesota. I would say that will be page one of the Star Tribune tomorrow and maybe elsewhere around the country. One of the other pieces that the government dropped in its opening statement today was the kind of the Mexico angle. It's just the Mexico and money angles of this case have dangled in various things that have been filed by the government up to trial and are mentioned in the opening statement and will have to be developed at trial.
Now, the Mexico, what is that, the Mexico angle?
Well, Mexico seemed to be the desired route that these guys were going to take. There was an East Coast route and there was a West Coast route. And four of these guys were apprehended on their way to Syria via JFK in New York City. Another contingent was apprehended on its way to Syria when they hit Southern California. But those guys were in the company of a government informer, a confidential human source who was disclosed in the opening statement today. So that they'd been led into taking up fake passports. They were in the process of buying fake passports in San Diego when they were apprehended. Well, that was part of the FBI operation to apprehend these guys. But prior to that, there was also interest in traveling to Syria through Mexico. At the direction, they were getting very express directions from one of these Minnesota guys who'd made it to Syria. That was flashed on the screen by the prosecution during the opening statement. This was a long text message or like that, or similar to that, giving these guys very express directions about the Mexican route to join them in Syria. And these guys were very interested in helping ISIS pioneer a reverse engineering that would allow ISIS to enter the United States through Mexico once they followed these instructions and made it. And in the discussions back and forth with the guys, between the guys in Minnesota and the guys in Syria, there's talk about, you know, these guys and the guys who made it, who are fighting with ISIS in Syria, they already look like Mexicans.
Oh, that's the highlight of the trial.
Oh,
so
there's
far.
More to come. Oh, man. Don't tell Donald Trump. He'll run with that one. So this is not one of those very rare cases where the identities of the jurors are concealed. These jurors are Minnesota people from the Twin Cities and surrounding area to the countryside. They're all specifically identified. Their hometowns are known. We have here some defendants where in the opening statement, at least, it's indicated that people in Syria sent them a list of 16 Minnesota soldiers that they wanted assassinated. How do you think that makes the jurors feel?
Well, you know, I sat through two days of voir dire, John, and it's really shocking to enter the court through the first floor where there are visibly armed agents patrolling the atrium of the courthouse. You go through heightened security. There are bomb-sniffing dogs on the first floor or roaming the halls. And they're clearly concerned about the security of the courtroom and the security of the judge, the security of the witnesses. And during voir dire, of course, the judge inquired of the prospective jurors about their attitudes toward terrorism. And one of the prospective jurors said, you know, to tell you the truth, I'm uncomfortable even being in the courtroom with these guys.
And so that juror, of course, got excused, right?
That's all it took.
Yeah, right, right. A very natural response.
And I think she expressed what's on a lot of people's mind when you start asking questions about the case.
Yeah, I'll bet. Well, I think we have some steaks to cook, don't we, John?
I think they're ready to go. The grill is hot, but you're the chef, man. You're the griller. So we'll sign off for now. And if you listen next time, you may learn how they turned out.
Okay.
Powerline is a production of PowerlineBlog.com. John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Mierendorf, Stephen Hayward, Joseph Malchow, and produced by Madison McQueen in association with Ricochet.com. Ricochet. Join the conversation.